We hope you enjoy this recording of Baby Talk, Understanding Your Baby, with Sue Jemison, lactation consultant and parent support counsellor at QIDU, the Irish Childbirth Trust. Recorded at Baby Talk Festival 2014. For more talks and information, visit babytalkfestival.ie.
I'm delighted to see so many folks still alive and kicking at 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon after the weekend. So we're going to have a wee look at three specific areas in the time that we have. And these, we'll just run through them. We're going to look at realistic sleep expectations. We're going to dispel a few myths about what babies can and can't do. And somebody put this up for me and said, oh, please talk about all those things that worry us sick. So I said, okay, we'll have a look at that. We'll see what we can do in there. So there'll be time for questions at the end. So if you have a big burning issue and you need to ask the question in the middle, fine. But if you can hang on to it and remember what it is, and that's a big tall ask when you have a small baby and you're a bit sleep deprived to remember something in 20 minutes' time. But if you can, that would be great. But I don't mind. If you need to ask me something, just stick a hand in the air. And if it's an appropriate moment to take a pause, that's what we do. Okay. So we're going to talk about baby sleep to begin with. There's a myth around baby sleep. This is what they do for most of the time, somewhere between somewhere and somewhere. So we're led to believe. Or we might have twinnies that curl up together and they might spend hours like this. Or they might be like this little doty pie. Or even this one. This is more normal. This is a more usual sleeping position for a mobile baby. If you can't see and you want to get up and move, feel free to jump across. And dads and babies and mums and babies. So this is the mythical image of baby sleep. And there's a nasty little insidious thing that we in Ireland are really good at. When your well-meaning friend sidles up to you and goes, is she a good baby? And you're going, of course she is, all babies are good. That is code for how much is your baby sleeping at night? And we are one of the few countries and cultures where a value judgment is made on your response to that question. Is she a good baby? Well, for a start, there's no such thing as a not good baby. Babies are babies are babies. And does she sleep at night? Well, my suggestion to you and my stock answer to that question is always the same, and that is, yes, she sleeps like a baby. Because what we know from the research is that babies are programmed to be awake. Not asleep, but awake a lot of the time. So we're going to look at some of the biology behind what's happening and why people get in a twist about sleep or lack of it. So that's where we're going to go on our little journey. Parents go to any lengths to try and get a bit of sleep. That's actually a video clip, and some of this will be posted on the Baby Talk website, so you're welcome to go and look it up. I didn't run it now because it's going to take up too much time, but basically it is a poor beleaguered father endeavouring to get a bit of sleep. I'm sure some of you have heard of the book that was published last year called Go the F to Sleep.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's actually very interesting because it was never designed as a children's book. It's an adult's book, but yet I've heard it being read to children. Guess who kept everyone awake here? Because there's always one. In your average family, there's always one. And this picture is actually from an article that was in The Observer. And actually the author is the woman sitting on the floor with her back against the cot and her 19-month-old daughter dancing a merry jig behind her. And the photographer was there to take a photo for the article that she was writing about parenting a toddler. And she sat down on the floor for 2 seconds and in 3 seconds she was asleep. So we've all been in that place as well. And so we're going to look at what's normal about sleep and what's not normal. So sleep comes in a kind of a variety of phases, and we're going to just look at two of them now because they're the two important ones. There's phase four sleep and there's REM sleep. And phase four sleep is the stuff that we get late in. It's the first big long sleep that you get. Is the phase four deep, deep sleep. You're in a coma. And for any of you who know what it's like to just fall asleep from complete exhaustion, that's where you go, into that coma sleep. And if anybody tries to wake you, they'll have a hard job. And when you do wake, you can be disorientated and not know what's going on. And at the other end of that scale, we have REM sleep, or dreaming sleep, which happens at the tail end of sleep. So there's stage four, is your deep sleep. Then we have REM at the other end. Now, there's all sorts of other stages in between. There's 4, 3, 2, 1, REM. But we don't need the middle stuff for our purposes today. We need the deep stuff and the light stuff. So that's what we're going to look at. All sleep happens in 90-minute cycles. This is a biological fact. This is not just a figure plucked out of the air. This is years and years and years of good research from competent sources. And the two best sources on sleep research are a woman called Helen Ball, and she works from the University of Durham in the UK, and they have a big sleep lab there. And the other guy is James J. McKenna, and he's from the University of Notre Dame in the US of A. And again, big sleep lab studies done there where they've observed parents and children during the night to see what they do. And there's masses of video clips watching what happens during the night. All of us, babies, children, adults, the whole lot of us, have about 5 to 8 little mini wake-ups during a long sleep. And what happens when your little child wakes up is that they wake up. What happens when we wake up? What do? We grab our pillow, we turn it over, we stuff it back in our ear and we go back to sleep because we know that that's what we're going to do. So we can do that. But it doesn't mean that you don't have these periods of wakefulness, because we all do. There's nobody that doesn't. You might say, I had a great night's sleep, I didn't wake at all. But actually, if you were videoed in the night, yes, you did. You woke up, you turned over your pillow, you stuck it in your other ear and you went back to sleep. And what's normal for infants, and I absolutely going to look at what's normal, what's expected and what's usual, is that for the first 6 to 8 weeks, infants reverse cycle. They are awake at night and asleep in the day. And that is what they do. And that's what they're supposed to do. They are supposed to be asleep in the day when it's a safe time, because we're going to look at in a minute why that is. So why is there a tiger on this picture? Because this is taken from some lovely writing, and again, all the references for this will be up on the Baby Talk website after today. Wonderful paediatrician, a buddy of mine in Canada called Jenny, and Jenny's website is called Dr. Jen for Kids, and she talks about tigers in the night. Tigers in the night. So that's why we have a tiger, to remind you that when do tigers hunt? They hunt at night. So why do babies need to be awake? Because the night time is essentially a dangerous time. Now, it's not dangerous for us in our modern homes with all our conveniences and our baby monitors and our listening devices. However, it's not that long ago since we were in a cave. In terms of evolutionary history, if you took a football pitch, the whole length of that football pitch is the length of time that modern humans have been on the earth. If you go right down to the thickness of the baseline on a pitch, it's about 1.5 inches. A white baseline painted on the pitch, that's the length of time that industrialised humans have been on the earth. A very, very, very short time. So our expectations of behaviour are based not on reality, not on biological fact, but on trying to make a baby with an evolutionary history of being awake be asleep. So that's kind of where we're coming from with baby sleep. We're trying to superimpose modern thinking on a very old, old biological evolutionary imperative that babies should stay awake at night to avoid trauma. So it's an evolutionary protection method, and that's why babies are awake at night. If you Google a particular thing, you get 54,400,000 results, and that was just one of the things that I Googled. There's many more. And what did I Google? Lullaby music. How am I going to get my baby to sleep? So there are 54 million varieties of ways of trying to soothe your baby to sleep, and none of them are particularly effective, because if it's nap time and if your baby is under 8 weeks of age, the chances are they're going to be awake. So that's normal baby behaviour. The only thing that you can reassure yourself with is that you're not the only one, that everybody with a newborn is going to be somewhere in the same place, and it doesn't last forever. And you mightn't feel like that when you're in it. When you're in it, it feels like it's going on and on and on. But I can promise you that I now have a 23-year-old, and the only way that it leaves its bed is with a shoehorn, a kick, cold water, 7 alarm clocks, and all the rest of the things. So this too will pass. So you're in the moment with a baby who needs your care and attention. And now we're going to look at why babies' needs are matched to their sleep. So that what they're doing is not unusual, it's quite normal. And Our babies are born very immature. Our human infant is possibly the most immature of all the mammal species. It can't get up and run after you if you move away. It can't hang on to you because we haven't got enough body fur, so we have to pick it up and carry it. So we're essentially a carry mammal. We take our children with us in arms when they can't walk. We're going to have a little quick dip into a survival guide here, because having told you all the horrors of early days, we now need to equip you with a few skills to keep you going along the way. So you're going to see the word survival coming up, beginning with S. And the most important message for new parents during the early weeks of life is sleep when your baby sleeps night and day, because you're on a 24-hour clock. So if your baby sleeps their best sleep, and they normally do anywhere from 7 a.m. till lunchtime, that's when you must be asleep. No cleaning the house, no hoovering, no cleaning baths, no cleaning toilets, no going shopping, you're sleeping. So if your baby is asleep in the first half of the day, so are you. And that is how you survive the early weeks, by sleeping when the baby sleeps. Use offers of help. So when somebody says, is there anything I can do for you? Our first response, because we're so independent, is to say, ah, no, I'm fine, thanks. So you've got to practice saying yes, because use offers of help, not to mind the baby, to mind you. Because you too will mind the baby if somebody else is minding you. So somebody else to feed you, somebody else to do a bit of shopping, and somebody else to throw a load of laundry in. Rest while feeding, and this is true regardless of your choice of feeding method. Take it as a timeout time. So if you're breastfeeding, take it as a timeout time. If you're formula feeding, take it as a timeout time. And really focus on feeding your baby in a very closely connected way, because feeding for babies is a huge priority. Any visitors that come in? Ladies, dressing gowns hanging out the front door for the first 6 to 8 weeks. So every time somebody comes to the door, you put your dressing gown on before you open the door, because then you are treated in a totally different way than if you arrive with a bit of makeup on and looking almost half normal. You are not half normal. You're deranged. So put your dressing gown on and allow yourself to be deranged and allow people to look after you. And investigate your local support groups. Close to the end of my little talk, we're going to look at support, because it's the single key ingredient for enjoying early days parenthood, is finding your local support mechanism in your community and linking into it so that you're never on your own. Very simple means, there's a big myth out there that you have to eat well. I don't care what you eat as long as you eat. I get you back to eating well in the fullness of time. But eat, just eat, anything at all. Because somebody said to me, oh, well, I didn't have very much today because I had nothing nice in the house. I said, have you any sweets? Any crisps? Anything? Crisp sandwich? Eat. Calories are more important in the early days than how good they might be, because none of us are malnourished. We'll all survive for a few weeks on whatever we happen to put our hand on. So panic not about food. And allow your partner to be involved. For some women, this is difficult, because they find that they spend so much more time with the baby that when their partner comes in from work, they're reluctant to hand them over, or else they'll do the other, they'll pick the baby up and thrust it into his arms without sort of checking in, is this okay? So make sure that your partner is actively involved, because what babies learn from the non-nutritive partner is that love, affection, cuddles and nurture come from another source as well as food. So it teaches babies that they can be loved, nurtured and cared for in every aspect in the early days, and it doesn't have to involve food. So make sure your partner is actively involved in the care and nurture of the offspring. And laugh, please laugh. Whenever you spend half an hour, 40 minutes getting ready to go out, you're all dressed up, you've got the baby wrestled into a snowsuit, you've figured out how the clip on the car seat works, you've got the baby loaded in, and suddenly the baby explodes. And there's a huge punami, and to your horror, not only can you visualise where it's coming, you can see it, it's actually appeared at the back of the neck. So out comes the car seat, out comes the baby, wash, clean. 3 hours and 45 minutes later, you haven't left the house. Give up. Give up. Just laugh and just give up. Because if you don't laugh when things are not going well, you will cry. And there are certain times when crying is a good thing to do, but most times if we're crying from frustration, then it's a bad thing to do. We just give up. Just slippers on, television on, feet up, packet of biscuits, cup of tea and give up. And you'll be a whole lot happier, because there's nothing that you should be doing. In these early days, there is nothing that you should be doing. There's things that you can do, that you could do, that you might do, but there is absolutely nothing that you should do apart from be with your baby. Nothing else. and it's all about the brain. This is why babies do what they do. Babies are born with about 25% of their brain developed at birth. It's the reptile stuff. Keep me warm, keep me fed, don't let tigers eat me. So the modern day baby equates tigers to adult stress. So if you are uptight, if your fists are clenched and your teeth are clenched, your baby will not feed, because that baby perceives those to be danger signals. You are doing fight or flight. You are sticking loads of cortisol out in the air, and the baby smells it, takes it on board, and goes, oh God, there's a tiger coming. And so they shut down, they won't feed, and they won't settle. As long as the parent who is having care of the baby at that time is up there, so is the baby. So it's stop everything, get calm, and off we go. So think reptile brain. Keep me warm, keep me fed, don't let tigers eat me. And when you meet those needs in arms, in early days, you get the payback over and over and over as the years go on. We're social mammals, and social mammals have masses of growing to do after they're born. We have what we call experiential learning. So our brains grow and proliferate by what we experience. And the next couple of slides are going to just push that home. Experiential learning, really, really important. So you're thinking external womb for the fourth trimester. So the 3 months after your baby's born, you replicate conditions in utero. You try and match exactly how the baby lived before it was born. Because the only reason our babies are born at 9 months is because of their big brain and their big head. And if you don't birth your baby somewhere around the 9 month mark, it's not going to fit, because the brain will go on growing, because it's only 25% of its adult brain function when it's born at 9 months. Every other primate mammal has a much higher functioning brain than the human mammal. So we grow the brain externally, and we grow it by experience. So all the things you do with your baby, playing, chatting, nurturing, being close, that's how you're growing your baby's brain. Not with colouredy toys, not with play mats, not with things that crinkle. You, your body, your proximity to your child is what's really important. Nothing else matters. Here's some interesting facts. Holding and carrying your baby increases DNA synthesis and keeps growth hormone going. So the baby who's in arms a lot of the time is growing optimally. And separation from a caregiver's body shuts that down. So that's why we see babies coming out of orphanages and things like that very underdeveloped for their age. They have got lots of food. They've got a certain amount of nurture, but they have none of this. The love, the nurture, the closeness, the oxytocin is what's missing. And it's oxytocin that drives babies' growth and development, and that comes in arms. And in the first year of life, the neocortex, which is the green area of that slide, builds up your area for thinking, reasoning, executive functions. And those go on. Read the last two words, folks. When do they grow up? The third decade. So that's why my 23-year-old has got 7 more years before his mother evicts him from the nest, finally, once and for all, because I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and allow him to keep growing and maturing his cortex all the way out to 30. And more for the men in the audience, I'm sorry to say, this is a longer, slower path for you than for most of the females, because they come to sexual reproduction quite young, 16 to 18. They tend to have reached their full neocortical function about 6 years earlier than most males. So the women in the audience, most of you are well there. Some of the men are still on the way. So panic not. And that is your higher function thinking comes towards the end of the third decade. So you're on a lifelong project here, folks. I think the day that I cried the longest when my firstborn was born, when I looked into a basket one day and thought, oh God, I've got to look after you for the next 18 years, I thought innocently. And I'm still loving and caring for adults in my family 30 plus years later, and so will all of you, as your parents still care for you and fuss about you when things are not going well for you. So once a parent, always a parent. You're stuck. Your brain, the baby's brain, develops up to about 60% of its adult function by the age of 1. So this first year is really critical in terms of your baby's growth and development. And that's why we don't panic about sleep or lack of it. Because all during those connecting hours of nighttime parenting, when your baby is partially awake and you're partially awake, you are growing a brain. You are creating positive experiences of nurture for that child that are going to grow them through their lifetime. If early life is distress-filled, the brain operates like a big threat detector. So every new experience is assessed to see, is it threatening? or is it not? Is it safe or is it not? So you have a baby on high alert the whole time. So their cortisol levels, their stress hormone levels are elevated throughout toddlerhood, and this is not good. Because that's the baby who's very hard to organise, who doesn't settle. So this baby needs even more nurturing and in-arms care, because we want our baby's brain to grow like this, unstressed, so that it can grow in all the ways that human beings are supposed to be. With our full potential, we should be intelligent, thoughtful and compassionate. And all of those are developed by nurture in-arms. So nurture in-arms, very, very important. Babies become what they experience. The brain learns what is practiced. And that comes from a wonderful book called The Oxytocin Factor by Kirsten Ugnes Moberg, and again, worth looking at. Oxytocin is the hormone of everything. It's the hormone of love. It's the hormone that made you make a baby in the first place. It's the hormone that you exude by buckloads when you eat chocolate. It's the hormone that you exude when you nurture and care for your baby. And it's the connecting hormone between adults as well. And the emotion systems get established and connected around the age of two. So the first 2 years of life are the nurture years, where you lay down the bedrock and the groundwork for your child for the rest of its life. So don't race through it. Be in the moment. Indulge the baby and indulge the child. So getting off to a good start, how do we do this? Ideally, mum and baby in skin-to-skin contact immediately after the birth. Touch stimulates oxytocin. So do your baby massage classes. Massage your baby every time you touch them, just stroke their body, and you're releasing waves of oxytocin that produce calm and order in the baby. And here are some mums just immediately after the births of the babies. Do you see the kind of benign smiles? That tells us that oxytocin is flowing in bucket loads. And these won't necessarily have been the ideal births either. Some of these are operative births, less than ideal. Yet once the mother and baby are in contact with each other, it melts. And the next few are a few dads in the same situation. Skin-to-skin contact, really important. Develops the oxytocin response. And here's some dads getting to know their little babies as well. And here's some comfy babies. Because what we know is that babies who are carried either in arms or in a sling learn the world from a very safe and secure environment. I just read a piece of research a couple of days back, it's just been published around what's happening for the infant in terms of physiology when they're carried, and it's totally different for the baby that's not carried. You don't have any issues with head shape with a carried baby, you don't have any issues with any of the things that can happen when a baby's on its back for long periods of time are not present when the baby's carried. You get a good strong neck and good developmental issues. So these are just some of the concerns, and we'll race through these because I know we're going to run out of time. How often should I feed my baby? How long should I feed my baby for? How do I know if he's had enough? Why does he cry? And where are the instructions? And I'll tell you where the instructions are, folks. You've all got them. The instructions are in you, in your genetic makeup, are the instructions for rearing your baby. So you don't listen to me. You don't listen to anybody else. You don't read, you absolutely don't read any how-to manuals. You do it for yourselves. You devise the child-rearing practice that works for you in your house, not following anybody else's rules. The person who's made the greatest money out of child-rearing information doesn't have a baby. Now, would you take your car to a car mechanic who hadn't studied engines and let them take it to bits? You would not. So why would you take information on child-rearing from somebody who's never done it? Because they're taking information that is designed for a population and extrapolating it downwards to one. And that's not a good plan. The good plan is to allow the baby to fit the pattern that works for you. So there is no right and wrong. There is no right way to raise your child. There's the way that works for you. So get your nodding and smiling heads on. Before you leave this room, I want everybody nodding and smiling. Because the next time somebody says to you, now what you should do is, you start nodding and smiling. Because you're going to say to them, that sounds like a plan. That sounds like something I might try. You are not going to justify your choices around child rearing. And you're not going to accept that what they're telling you might work for you. But you're going to accept it and hear it so that they think that they've helped. And they're going, oh, she listened to me, that was great. She'll be fine now. No, she's listened to me. Everything will be fine. So listen to nobody, listen to yourselves. And if it doesn't, I talked to a couple of parents yesterday down on the Quidju stand who had been given information by AN Other about what they should do. And the list was shocking and frightening. And if I had been that new parent, I would have given my baby away straight away on the spot because it wasn't feasible or practical. and they were not told to trust their own judgment. They were not told to follow their instincts, or that they were a good enough parent, because a good enough parent is all you have to be. Good enough. How come nobody told me about this? I'll tell you why. We do tell you. We try very hard, Auntie Natalie. We try to tell you what's coming, but because you're focused on the birth, you can't hear us. You can't hear us. So that's why you need to join some postnatal support set up afterwards, where you can actually hear the things that can help, because Auntie Natalie, you cannot hear us. So even when we tell you and show you loads of funny pictures and jump up and down and sing and dance for you, you can't hear us because you're focused on the birth. Because that's the most important thing for you at that time. So we, as I say, we do try to tell you a little bit about things. But patterns of feeding. Baby needs to double his birth weight in 6 months. He starts out with a tummy the size of a walnut, and it grows to the size of a small hen's egg. So if you imagine, none of us are trying to grow anymore. Am I going to take you almost to the end with a picture of an average Saturday in my house a couple of months ago, just to prove a point. When it comes to the number of times, how often do we eat or drink something in 24 hours? Put your hands up if you think it's 3. Put your hands up if you think it's 5. 8? Are we getting there? 8? 8 to 12 times in 24 hours. What do we ask of our babies? 8 to 12 times in 24 hours. They're the same as us. They're not doing anything different. It just feels like it's different, but it's the same. This is me. Glass of orange juice about 8:30 in the morning. Very nice. Because it's Saturday, him indoors, who's going to go off for the whole day with the lads, decides he'll humour me with a little bit of cooked breakfast. So we have that at about 10:30. Followed later on, because my sister happened to wander in with a cup of coffee and a biscuit. She's going off to meet some of her gal pals for a noodly lunch. And I say, I know, I've had a bit of fried breakfast, I won't come. Nice. The company was enticing, so off we went and we had our noodle lunch. And I had a banana in my handbag because I'm desperately trying to be healthy, so a banana was pushed down the hatch as well. And another couple of biscuits and another cup of coffee. And we're only just at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I've already eaten 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 separate things have already gone down the hatch, and we're only got to the middle of the afternoon. So on we go. Lasagna for dinner with a glass of wine. Followed by a Magnum, because he loves me and it was stashed in the freezer. Followed by a pear, because I'm still trying to be healthy despite all this excessive heat. And later on, another cup of coffee. And then very much later on, some more wine left over from the lasagna. And then because we had noodles at lunchtime and lasagna and salty rashers at breakfast, very thirsty. So during the middle of the night, several mugs of water. And this is a person who's reasonably content with her size and weight, who truly doesn't want to gain another ounce. And I've just dispatched 2,500 calories. So we're look at a baby who's trying to double its birth weight with a tummy the size of a small hen's egg. They have to eat, and they have to eat, and they have to eat, and they have to eat. And on it goes up to the 4th and 5th year of life, because they're growing a brain. It's all about the big brain. Good news for those who've chosen to breastfeed. If you go jogging with small weights, you're going to burn about 30 calories in 10 minutes. If you go skipping, you're going to burn about 30 calories per 500 skips. If you lie on your back in your bed watching all those box sets that you haven't had time to watch, you're going to burn about 500 calories a day. So that's another good reason to consider breastfeeding if you haven't considered it. So this is our support side, and this is the last. Share experiences with others. It's really important that you talk to other people about where you've been, where your journey has taken you. Bit of understanding in the support group. They've all been there and done that and got many, many t-shirts. There's plenty of partner involvement. We have social events. This is Quidgy now particularly. We have social events. We have 5-a-side footy for dads. There's all sorts of things. Postnatal support, your local group in your local area where you're going to meet other young parents. And get out and about, do not stay at home, wrap yourself up, grab your baby and go out the door. And remember your own needs too, because you do need a little bit of me time. You actually occasionally need to sit on a loo at the odd time by yourself. Very nice, a real luxury. And trust your instincts, because at the end of the day, whose baby is it anyway? It's your baby, there are no rights and wrongs. The sleep issue is to do with growing the brain, And in order to grow the brain, the baby needs to be awake more than it's asleep. So there's no problem in the first 2 years of life if your baby is awake a lot. Content yourself that you're growing a fine human being for the next generation and that this too will pass. And to the best of my knowledge, I could not find one reference to anybody dying from sleep deprivation. You might feel great, but you won't die. Thank you very much.